Welcome to the Hockey Writers Podcast, where your favorite THW contributors discuss the hottest topics around the NHL and hockey world every weekday, Monday through Friday. Listen daily on iHeartRadio and wherever you get your podcasts, and make sure to check out our other great content at thehockeywriters.com. I'm your host, Kyle Knopp, and today I'm joined by Colin Newby and Patrick Brown. Colin, Patrick, how are you guys doing on this Wednesday?
Doing great, Kyle.
Excellent. Colin?
Doing great. Stayed up late to watch some hockey, the Western Conference games. Had a cold beer, a small wager, and I'm pumped for today.
Well, the good news was that overtime only lasted a minute and 12 seconds, so you didn't have to stay up too much later than that. The bad news was the overtime only lasted a minute and 12 seconds, and it just all of a sudden ended as soon as it began. So, but let's jump right into it. Colin is our Metropolitan Division specialist, and the Metro has been quite interesting these playoffs. Carolina won last night to go up 3-2 in their series, as every home team has walked away victorious between the Carolina Hurricanes and the Boston Bruins. Pittsburgh Penguins are up 3-1 and can become the second team to clinch tonight as they go against the New York Rangers, while the Washington Capitals have been giving the Florida Panthers a run for their money, tied 2-2 heading back to Sunrise. So I just want to get your thoughts on what's been going on in the Metro. What has surprised you? Who has impressed you the most? And who you think will be coming out of these series? So, Colin, take it away.
Sure. So I wanted to talk about the Bruins and Hurricanes first. Well, first of all, last week, the three of us sat and talked and said this might be a sweep. Yeah, that one got reversed real fast.
We did. We thought with Jari out that the Penguins didn't really have an opportunity, and here they are playing with their third string goalie, and are up 3-1. So, you want to touch on that series a little more? Yeah.
But just to step back to the Bruins for a minute, the thing that I've really enjoyed in this series. And a reason I fell in love with this sport in the first place, the game within the game. Yes. Brad Marchand and Tony DeAngelo are really on each other's nerves right now. Brad Marchand had 5 points in game four, and it certainly got under DeAngelo's skin, because when Marchand scored an empty netter, his second goal of the game, DeAngelo just chucked a stick in the air. I don't know if it was to stop Marchand out of frustration, whatever he was doing. But that's when Boston tied the series 2-2 in game four. And then DeAngelo comes back in game five. He looks excellent as the power play QB for them. He's a great passer. He ended up with a goal and 2 assists in the Hurricanes' victory. And that now they've gone up 3-2.
I got to tell you, the stick toss took me back to my street hockey days. Not going to lie. when we wouldn't have a goaler and, you know, we had to play posts.
Yeah.
Somebody ends up with a breakaway. Oh, yeah. That's the stick throw. You don't see that too often in the NHL. That took me back to my street hockey days. That was fun.
No, you got to do.
Usually that results in a penalty shot. So,
oh, yeah.
That's why you don't see it happen very often. But I guess when there's no goalie in net, it doesn't really matter at that time. So,
right. For sure. Oh, it was just, I couldn't help but laugh. And, you know, nobody, you don't want to see a professional player throwing their stick. Nobody got hurt, so you're okay to laugh about it, but it was harmless. But yeah, I just couldn't help but take me back to those days in the cul-de-sac with no goalie, playing posts, and my brother ends up with a breakaway, so chuck the all east and see what happens.
Absolutely.
Things can get testy out there. I'm not surprised. But to move on to the Penguins and Rangers, I think you have to just continue to laud Pittsburgh as a team that I've grown up to hate my whole life. It pains me to say that. But Pittsburgh has just done an unbelievable job. Crosby has 9 points right now.
Yeah.
He's just ridiculous all over the ice. He's such a complete all-around player, even at this stage in his career. And then Pittsburgh has Brian Dumoulin, Rickard Rakell, and Tristan Jarry out. I heard Josh Getzoff, the Penguins play-by-play guy, talking about Mike Sullivan yesterday, and he really is at the top of the food chain of NHL coaches. because to be missing one of your best defensemen, a key winger, and your starting goaltender, and be up 3-1 on the New York Rangers, he seems to just always find a way.
He absolutely does. I mean, he came in and really turned that franchise around back when he led them to back-to-back Stanley Cups. And now he's doing it again. I mean, no one thought Pittsburgh was going to be in the playoffs this year. Most of the season, people were thinking this was the year Pittsburgh was going to end their streak of playoff, of active playoff appearances. And what did they do? They spent half the season without Sidney Crosby, half the season mm-hmm. without Evgeny Malkin, and they are still tearing it up. They still finished with over 100 points on the season. They are up 3-1 against what is arguably the best goaltender in the National Hockey League this season. So, yeah, Pat, I'd like to get your thoughts on that series. Where has Pittsburgh come from, and how can the Rangers have any chance of turning this around?
I don't know if they do at this point. I mean, it's 3-1. My old boss at my old company, who I'm still really good friends with, is a big Rangers fan. So I reminded him the Leafs blew a 3-1 lead because he's pretty inconsolable right now. Yeah. But look, I think we talked about this last week. I think this comes down to that veteran experience against a team that just has to go through some losing before they're going to start winning. I think when you look at the Boston Carolina series and how Carolina responded after Boston tied it up, it's because Carolina's been there.
Yes.
New York really hasn't. And despite the loads of talent that they have on that roster, they're still probably a year or two away from seriously contending for the cup. Not to say they can't make a run and make it to the final. Anything can happen in the playoffs, but they're inexperienced. These are the things that these up and coming teams have to go through. And on the flip side of that, Pittsburgh and what could be their last gasp, right, at a championship, and the veterans know it on the team. They're not getting any younger. They know what it takes to win a cup. They've done it, what, three times. Yeah. They know what it takes to win a cup. And that's what they're doing right now. They are putting on a clinic against a young Rangers team. And just, I couldn't believe when I checked the score of the game the other day, and I think it was 6-2 or I was like, what? I didn't expect that. But
yeah, it's seven goals in back-to-back games.
Yeah. And you know, the Rangers, I think, thought twice.
Yeah.
Well, and it's not, I haven't been following Rangers media lately or even Rangers fans. So I hope they're not pointing the finger at Shesterkin, because there's plenty of blame to go around.
Oh yeah.
And I think the Rangers may have thought they could ride him into the second round. And that is not how the playoffs work. You do want the hot goaltender, but you also got to play defense and you got to score goals. So I think, you know, this comes down to kind of one of the things we talked about last week, that veteran presence in the lineup versus the rookie team that has some learning to do. And unfortunately for the Rangers and their fans, they're doing some learning right now the hard way.
So you brought up a good point, and I want to ask both of you this question. You mentioned that Carolina has been that team that has that experience losing in the playoffs and now is kind of getting over that hump. However, they are without two veteran defensemen in Ethan Bear and Dougie Hamilton, who were a big part of those teams in those playoff pushes in the past. Now they have Tony DeAngelo in there, who's leading their power play, who is also a playoff rookie. How is this team different compared to, you know, the Rangers, who have a Fox and a couple other guys who are a little more experienced, but not necessarily at the playoff experience? Colin, I'll start with you. How does this defensive core for Carolina have that bit of an edge over the New York Rangers?
Well, I think you also have to point to Jacob Slavin in there.
Okay.
Just being the type of player that he is, he's not going to get as much attention as even DeAngelo, who's been a very controversial figure off the ice. So that makes him a bigger name. And then on the ice, he's going to put up better numbers. We were just talking about his power play acumen, which is excellent. But Slavin is a great all-around player himself. I don't think he'll be in the conversation for the Norris Trophy because he doesn't always have the best offensive output, but that doesn't mean he's not one of the most valuable players out on the ice as a defenseman. And I think he's the type of glue that you need to hold it together when you have guys like D'Angelo, as you mentioned, are not as experienced.
Yeah, Jacob Slavin's a great call out. He's got 2 goals and 3 assists in 5 games so far. He's a +9, scoring a point per game and shooting at a 22.2 clip, which is not too shabby, while averaging almost 23 minutes a game. So, Pat, coming back to you, same question. How does this Carolina defense, although also slightly inexperienced, have the upper edge on the New York Rangers?
Well, I think you can still look to your veterans who've been there. I think you could look at the Stahls and the Ajos and even at the top, Rod Brind'Amour, who, I mean, they were on the team mm-hmm. who went to the conference finals and got swept a few years ago against the Bruins. Mm-hmm. So they're no strangers to the playoffs. And I think, you know, in my mind, you're not just looking offense looks to offense, defense looks to defense. We're looking collectively at the experience that these teams have. And I think it starts at the top with the coach. And Brind'Amour has been there as a player and now as a coach for many, many seasons. And collectively, they know how to carry themselves. They know when their backs are against the wall, what they need to do. And that's a good thing, because while we talked about Boston being a bad matchup for them last week, you know, Boston also knows what it takes. So when you're up against a team that knows what it takes, even if you have them outmatched, which I still believe the Hurricanes have the Bruins outmatched.
Yeah.
But when they're a veteran team, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because they know what it takes. The playoffs are a totally different ballgame. And so I don't focus as much on whether the defense is young and the offense is experienced, vice versa, blah, blah, blah. I always kind of look at it collectively. And I think Carolina, I know Carolina's got the leadership on this team with a lot of their core that's been there for a few years that even dates back to that 2018-2019 conference finals appearance. And they know what it takes. So that's kind of where I am on it.
Okay, absolutely. And so by that measure, do they go and break that streak of losses on the road tomorrow?
I think they close it out tomorrow. I do. I think they got it together the other day. I think Boston put together one hell of a last gasp, if you will. Okay. I said last week I didn't think it was going to go any more than 5, and I was wrong. So we'll see. But I think I did. I think I did say, I have to go back and listen. I think I did say 5-6 max, I think. Okay. But I think the Hurricanes close it out. Absolutely.
All right. I got to agree with you there, Pat. I think the home and home switches here have gone on long enough. I think Carolina still is the better team, despite that rush by Boston. They were excellent in the 2 games in Boston beforehand. But I do think Carolina still closes out in game 6.
I'm going to have to agree with both of you there. I think both teams played extraordinarily well in Boston, and Boston did just enough to get by in those 2 games to even that series. Carolina was just a bit too much for them back in Carolina last night. And I think on Thursday, you're going to see Carolina, if they really want to make this push this year, they have to learn to win on the road, and it has to come in this game. They can't get forced back to Raleigh. So I agree. I see this finishing in 6. And then one other series that we have to talk about that we kind of brushed over a little bit last week, but you know, Washington's in the Metro and they are giving Florida a run for their money. They are tied 2-2 heading back to Sunrise. What's going on in that series? Who has impressed you there? And can Washington upset the President's Trophy winners? And I'll start with you, Colin.
Well, I thought it was going to happen. It looked like Washington was going up 3-1.
Yeah.
They had a 1-goal lead in the final minutes the other night, an empty netter right on their plate. It hits the side of the net, and all of a sudden it's still a 1-goal game. And the Panthers tie it up with under 2 minutes to go in the third period, end up winning in overtime. I think that was the turning point of the series. Washington really had the upper hand They had that 2-1 lead. They were playing very physical hockey, and that goes back to what Pat talked about. These teams that have been in the playoffs year after year, they know what it takes. They know the playoff style of hockey. I think they really had Florida on the ropes, a more talented team that didn't necessarily have as much experience. And I think they just let them off the hook. They let them come back in the final minutes there. They lost in overtime. Verhaeghe with that big goal. But I think that Florida, now that they have evened it up, they've kind of survived that hurricane that Washington was throwing at them. And I think their talent will take over now. I think that was just a huge turning point and probably a moment that you're going to look back at in a couple weeks and say, wow, that really was huge for the Florida Panthers.
Go ahead, Pat.
Yeah, so I'm going to contradict myself here, and I understand that. But so first of all, I'm a firm believer that momentum does go period to period, but it does not go game to game. I do not believe that momentum goes game to game. However, just to contradict what I just said, Colin hit the nail on the head. Florida's goal with 3 minutes or whatever, just over a minute left, I think it was, to tie it up and then obviously winning in overtime, was that pivotal moment you look for in a series. I'll never forget back in 2002 when the Red Wings were down 2-0 against the Vancouver Canucks and Nicholas Lidstrom scored on Dan, why can't I remember his name? The goalie. Anyway, Vancouver's goalie.
It might have been Dan Cloutier.
I was confusing him with the Full House guy, but I think I have Dan Cloutier's name right.
Coulier.
Okay, so I did Dave have Coulier. Dan, but Dan Cloutier was the goalie of the Canucks. I'm almost positive. Yes. Lidstrom scored from center ice. Wings were down 2-0. President's Trophy winners, ironically enough, actually. And I remember my brother and I, when Lidstrom scored from center ice, my brother and I looked at each other. We didn't even celebrate the goal. We just looked at each other. We said, there it is.
Yep.
And you look for that pivotal moment in a series, and I think that was it. I think Colin hit the nail on the head. So even though I do not believe momentum itself goes game to game, I do think that moment that Colin was talking about, that goal to send it to overtime and ultimately the overtime winner, is that pivotal moment in the series where Florida can look back potentially after they are hoisting the cup and say, that changed our playoff fate.
Absolutely. I think that is 100% correct. I mean, they were called the cardiac cats for a reason, right? They had the most comeback victories in a season in quite a long time. I think they had over 25 comeback victories from the third period alone or something like that. Something's crazy this season. I don't have the stat in front of me, but I mean, that was their MO this season. They would hang around just enough late in games and then get that one or two goals, come back into the game, and then end up getting that win late or in overtime. And I think you're absolutely right. That empty net miss there was kind of the dagger in the Caps' heart that just kind of, if that would have gone in, they would have been up by two with a little over 2 minutes to go. I think it was maybe 3 minutes to go. It would have just been a whole different ball game. And, you know, credit
can
to
we
Florida.
Can we so I don't know if you guys watched Biz and Tockett after almost not come to blows, but very big disagreement as to whether or not you take a shot at that empty net.
Yeah.
But I'm just curious your guys' thought on that, because obviously, by the way, that miss, the near miss, ended up being called icing, which then they couldn't change. Florida held the zone and scored. Yep. Right. So do you take that shot when you've been on the ice that long, you got tired legs? Do you agree in taking the shot? And I'm just curious your guys' thoughts, because Biz and Tock had a great debate about that. And I'm in team shot. I think you absolutely take the shot. I think if it goes in, you're celebrating, you're moving on. And if it doesn't, you got to trust your guys to win the cup, to win the draw and clear the zone. But I'm curious what you guys think about that. Do you agree with taking the shot from inside your own zone down to the empty net, or do you think you try to just clear the zone?
Colin, go ahead.
I don't really think that you need to be as aggressive as they are. If you go back maybe 10 years, you would not have seen that type of thing happen very often. Teams are being so much more aggressive on the empty netters now. And hey, there's a reason for that. An empty netter essentially ends the game. I mean, I guess you still could make it a 2-goal game and come back from that, but insurmountable odds almost. But that's become more common lately. But I feel like a lot of the empty netters, especially with teams pulling the goaltender earlier, are by the book, just clearing the zone as you would on 5-on-5. And once you hit center ice and maybe hit the opposing blue line, well, you have so much more high percentage of a shot. And like you said, you run that risk for icing when you do something like that, and it can keep tired legs on the ice, send your team back into your own zone, and put yourself in a bad position there.
Yeah, I gotta say, I'm on the side of defense first. So as a coach in a tight game like that, you got to get that puck out of your zone, especially if you're toward the end of your shift. Just get it out of the zone, get it, you know, over the red line, get it deep. Don't even try to score there. Just get it out of the zone, get a change, get those fresh legs on. If you're at the beginning of your shift, yeah, go ahead, take that shot, because you're going to be at least in a spot where you're fresh if you lose that faceoff and you can battle in your zone. If you're already in a 30-second, 40-second shift, you should just be getting that puck out of your zone, over the red line, so you can change. And you know, you never want to try and play to not lose a game. You always want to play to win. But in that, you know, in a 1-goal game and a chance to take a series 3-1 lead heading back on the road, you have to play for that win. And in that situation, playing for that win is just getting the puck out of your zone and playing defense first.
Nah, playing for the win is shooting to score and go up by 2. I disagree with that. I love it. I love it.
They lost though, so it didn't work.
Yeah, but what if it goes in? What if it goes in? Then they win, and you're not in that position. So this is the genesis of the debate, and I love it. It's exactly why I asked the question. Right. Because it's basically what type of coach are you, I think, is what it boils down to. And I love it, boys. I love it. Thanks for playing along.
Absolutely. Thank you for having that in the holster. So
it's good stuff.
All right. Well, moving on. Last night was the 2022 NHL draft lottery, and New Jersey was essentially the winner, moving up 4 spots to number 2. Although Montreal did win the first overall pick, which was the second year in a row that the team that had the worst record in the regular season ended up with the lottery pick. The last time that did not happen was to our Red Wings, Patrick. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on how the lottery played out. What do you think of New Jersey getting another top 4 pick? And what do you think of Montreal getting the first overall pick in Montreal? And Patrick, I'll come to you first on this one.
You know, I was actually at Gila River yesterday for the Coyotes, just in case they took the first overall, which obviously they didn't. Coyotes ended up 3rd, which is they dropped 1 spot. But, you know, as for Montreal, in Montreal, everybody was kind of laughing yesterday. It's like, and you don't see them pull the balls. You don't see. Is it rigged? Is it rigged? The fix is in. Obviously not, but. I'm trying to give the league the benefit of the doubt here. Look, it's Montreal had the best shot of winning, right? Yeah. Montreal had the best shot. We asked Bill Armstrong after how they felt about 3rd and everything, and he said, look, every GM's a competitor, every GM wants the number 1 pick. But he kind of joked, he said, I said I did the draft randomizer for a whole day once. And you know what I came away with? We have a 13% chance of getting the top pick, is what he said. I don't know if it was true or not that he sat on Tankathon and did it all day, but I hope that's true, because that's phenomenal, by the way. But I think that's just it. So, you know, I think if you're New Jersey, you're happy. I think if you're Arizona, you're content because you didn't drop to 4. Most people around here thought they were going to drop from 2 to 4. If you're Montreal, you're thrilled. And if you're Seattle, maybe you're a little jaded. But it is what it is. This is why the draft lottery exists. Everything pretty much went according to plan, with the exception of the Devils moving up to two. So, you know, that's interesting. But I think, you know, you're looking Montreal. It'll be interesting to see the environment in Montreal at the draft. That's going to be exciting.
Oh, it's going to be crazy
for them. But also not much mystique around who's going to get taken. And who they expect to go. So, it'll be fun to watch. It's kind of gimmicky. It's funny. They have a 30-minute thing around it when it could just be a press release, but
oh yeah,
anything for that money. Right. So,
the TV rating.
Yeah.
Yep, got to sell ad revenue. So, real quick, who is Arizona taking at number three?
Oof, I don't know if I was ready for that question.
I had to throw you one.
Well, I don't. It depends who's. I mean, it depends who's available. I'd love to see Cooley.
Like, I think it's going to be Cooley. I think.
Love to see Cooley, but does New Jersey take him at two? Is the question. So,
New Jersey, you know, there's a stack down the middle though. So I think they're going to end up taking Jurkowski, but we'll see.
There's a fair chance there's Cooley there. Gosh, what was the other name? Literally popped in, and it was Savoy, but he's kind of dropped lately.
Yeah, Savoy's dropped a little. So it's either going to be, it's really going to be either Cooley or Jurkowski. I mean, yeah, are essentially going to be.
Well,
your top,
I mean,
top two
you never know. Nobody said Heisman was going to take Sider at six, and now you got a Calder finalist. So, you know, it'll be interesting. But I actually was talking with our friend Christy, who reports for the New Jersey Devils, was talking to her a little bit after the lottery yesterday, and we were debating whether or not Cooley was gonna fall, and she seems to think that Cooley would probably not be selected by the Devils either. So if Cooley's available, I think he would go to the Coyotes.
I think so. I think New Jersey has quite a bit of centers in their pipeline coming up. They're young down the middle. They need some help on the wings. Or defense, but there's not really any D I see going top two, top three. So I think they're going to end up going with a winger there, but like you said, you never know.
Absolutely. All right,
Colin, coming over to you. I'd like to get your thoughts on the draft lottery last night. New Jersey moving up four spots to number two, Montreal with the first overall pick in Montreal. What are your thoughts, and how do you see this playing out?
I like to see things a little bit more randomized than they were. As you said, Montreal had the best odds, got the best pick, and New Jersey has also had some luck in the past. I think what that type of outcome promotes is what I just really hate about roster construction in the NHL and in professional sports in general. And that's this concept of tanking. I think it's terrible for the game. I think there's way too much emphasis on it. And if the first team does get the number one overall pick, well, it's just going to promote teams to tank next year, because they'll say, see, well, it worked for the Montreal Canadiens. Mm-hmm. They were terrible. And now Shane Wright is their best player. And I don't know if he will be, especially next year. But you get the point I'm trying to make. These franchise altering players going to the worst teams, sure, that's the idea of the draft, but I think tanking is the real enemy here, and I just wish that it wasn't a part of the sport. I wish that the lottery would do whatever it could to try to get that out of the game, and I don't think that that's what happened last night.
I absolutely agree. I think that part of the beauty of the league is the parity of it, and you know, to have more teams be able to kind of jump up higher will help with that. And then I'm also still a little salty from a few years ago. The Red Wings put up one of the worst seasons in NHL history and didn't moved down three spots. So I'm kind of still salty about that. I'm interested to see what happens, but we'll see. So Colin, as a Philadelphia Flyers contributor, where do you see them picking at number five?
I was reading a lot last night, and I'll have my own piece coming out this afternoon about this. I'm going to go with the most likely candidate being Simon Nemec.
Okay.
He's probably the best defenseman in this draft. The Flyers, in their history and especially recently, have become obsessed with right-handed defensemen. It's a sentiment that does exist around the league that right-handers are harder to find than lefties on defense.
Mm-hmm.
But Nemich, he could slide in a right-handed role for the Flyers. I think he's the most likely candidate. The guys you mentioned also, if Slafkovský falls, I would love to see the Flyers get him. I don't think he'll be available at five.
Yeah.
Savoy is another name I've heard thrown around. Charlie O'Connor of The Athletic has written a lot about him potentially as a target for the Flyers, and I like what he's had to say and what Savoy can offer the team.
Awesome. All right. Well, moving on, let's move into our final segment today, the articles of the day, keeping us on time here. I'm going to start. So my article of the day is by Zach Rode, and it is Buffalo Sabres player season report card, Tage Thompson. So Zach goes on to talk about Tage Thompson's season this year with the Buffalo Sabres. And to me, Tage Thompson kind of came out of nowhere. He was a rookie in 2017-2018 with the St. Louis Blues. He played 41 games, had 3 goals, 6 assists for 9 points. Bounced around between the AHL and NHL that year, was sent over to Buffalo the next season, bounced around the next three seasons between the NHL and AHL, the Rochester Americans, never putting up more than 14 points in the NHL. Here he comes out, explodes this year in 78 games. He has 38 goals, 30 assists for 68 points, and just absolutely came onto the scene as one of Buffalo's strongest players. So Zach does a great job of breaking down what his expectations were, how his season shaped, and what he looks like as the future centerpiece in that Buffalo Sabres organization. So that is Buffalo Sabres player season report card, Tage Thompson by Zach Rode. Colin, I'm going to come over to you. What is your article of the day?
I have Bobby Orr's flying goal. This is actually an updated piece from yesterday, but it was originally published a few years ago by Drew Johnson. But he talks about Bobby Orr's season back in 1969-70. I'll read the list of awards here. The Hart, the Norris, the Art Ross, and the Conn Smythe, and his first ever Stanley Cup. He had 120 points in 76 games that year. And Drew also talked about the stretch of 8 straight Norris trophies a little later in his career. But I thought the historical element of this piece was excellent. He had some good research in the historical context. Digging up some key details in the playoffs from 1970 isn't really that easy. And one thing added from that iconic moment with Bobby Orr's flying goal is that it put the Bruins back on the map in New England. They had a long Stanley Cup drought before that, but it's such a good sports market up there. And those 70s teams, the big bad Bruins, are some of the best in their franchise history. That put them back in the conversation with the other three sports. So check that out. Bobby Orr's flying goal on the Hockey Writers.
Such a great article, such a great just photo, just iconic photo. And one of those memories that, you know, I know sticks in the heart of Boston Bruins fans and in the heart of a lot of NHL fans that grew up in that era. So great, great article. Make sure to check that out. Patrick, over to you, my friend. Your article of the day.
Yeah, really quick too. I remember being in Boston. I stayed right across the street from the garden and had a beautiful view of that statue. And
oh yeah,
super cool. Super cool. Anyways, my article of the day by Connor Smith, Chicago Blackhawks, pros and cons of keeping Derek King as head coach. I think it kind of speaks for itself. Just kind of looking into why or why not the Blackhawks keep King. So obviously Blackhawks have been through quite a bit this season, all self-inflicted, all terribly embarrassing and a bad look for the organization. So is King the right guy to keep around to help, you know, continue to promote a much better culture within that organization? And that's kind of what Connor Smith looks at in his post. So I would say go check it out. I think he makes some really good arguments, both for and against. Gives you some good things to think about. I don't want to give any spoilers, but again, Chicago Blackhawks, pros and cons of keeping Derek King as head coach. Go check it out.
Excellent. All great articles of the day. Please make sure that you're checking those out at thehockeywriters.com. And thank you for listening to this episode of the Hockey Writers Podcast. Listen to new episodes Monday to Friday on iHeartRadio and wherever you get your podcasts. And make sure to check out our other great content at thehockeywriters.com. From Kyle Knopp, Colin Newby, and Pat Brown, this has been the Hockey Writers Podcast.
Good job, guys.